Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you may be listening. Mike Carpenter here with Alan Beebe.
Hoi hoi.
For the Decadence Podcast, episode number 5. And this is pretty cool because for the first 4, people have only had an opportunity to listen to us wax philosophical about music. But for the first time, we have a guest on the Decadence Podcast, and it is Ward Gollings here from Champaign Urbana, a promoter, a booker. What would be the proper title, Ward?
Oh, it's always a tough question. It's such a hodgepodge. When people ask me that, I usually say entertainment director.
I think that's a fair title.
Entertainment director and special events coordinator. Both of those.
Full band concierge.
Yeah.
And you have been, the venues that you work with in town include Cowboy Monkey, High Dive. Are those the two primary ones?
That's the two primary. I'm involved, again, special events coordinator. I'm involved in some other stuff, like did a outdoor thing in the parking lot outside Soma this year. I've helped coordinate some things out at Jupiter's at the Crossing. Outdoor events and some indoor events, I guess, as well. I've also co-promoted some shows at Canopy Club or just all over.
So for the musical odyssey, kind of a pretentious term, but how did it begin for you? And I know that's kind of a big, loaded question, but if you were to kind of pinpoint the first moment where you said, okay, rock and roll, that's it for me. Was it a song? Was it a moment? A TV? Is it some band performing on TV? Or?
No, I mean, I was always into music. Got into punk rock music, I guess, midway through high school or something like that. And then came to U of I. And about 2 years into school here at U of I, a buddy of mine started just randomly booking some shows at a place called Trito's Uptown, which is the corner of 6th and Green. It's now Campus Crusade for Christ.
Oh, so it was the upstairs part.
Yeah, it was back when the Rantoul Air Force Base was still open, and they would have all the flyboys down on the weekend and, you know, have a DJ and it'd be crowded. But then they had nothing going on like Sunday through Wednesday, other than their restaurant business, their sandwiches and grinders. So we just kind of stepped in and started doing stuff, like really just $2 shows, you know, a lot of indie bands. A whole bunch of like the old Sub Pop bands, like
from the Seattle label,
yeah,
that would travel through here.
Yeah, Nirvana played there for $2, and there was two for $1 old styles.
Jeez,
I got hammered that night, but Screaming Trees played there.
Wow, Mark Lanegan's band.
What's
right?
That?
Mark Lanegan,
indeed.
Right?
Whole bunch of great bands, you know. That was back when, you know, indie rock sort of was blossoming, I guess you would say. But anyway, he did that for about a year, and I sort of just helped him doing flyers and tickets and working the door or, you know, humping some gear here and there or whatever, or just, again, a hodgepodge of things. And then he moved, graduated, I forget which, or transferred. I think he moved. Shortly thereafter, I had been working the whole time at Record Swap, which used to be down on Green Street above, a little bit, sort of above Murphy's.
Is it where Zaz is right now? Or I'm trying to remember because it was
no,
next to Zorba's?
Other side of the street, kind of above Murphy's.
Okay. Oh, the old Record Swap. Okay, I was thinking Record Service back when that was on the south side of Green.
Record Swap. They were both down there, which was a great time. You had two record stores down. But anyway, the owner of Record Swap, Bob, was going in with Chris Knight, who, as you probably know, owns the Blind Pig here in town. And they were opening what was going to be a juice bar, you know, and have some bands or whatever. Shortly after they got started, or even before they got started, before they opened the doors, Chris Knight realized that he needed beer. He needed a liquor license. And amongst all that, he and Bob just had a bit of a falling out, and Chris just bought him out. I got to back up. Before all that happened, that's what it was. Sorry. I was working at Record Swap. So I said to Bob, I said, hey, I know some bands from having helped my buddy. You know, I know, you know, I've got some contacts. I'd like to bring a couple shows in to the new place, you know, here and there if I could, you know, because I knew the guys in the Afghan Whigs at that point. I knew the guys in Smashing Pumpkins at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, some cool bands like that. And Bob just said flat out, it surprised me, and just said, well, you just want to book the whole thing? And I was a little bit taken back, I guess.
Are you still a college student at this time?
I was probably only 22 at that point, 21. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I was really young. So, you know, I did. I said yes and started doing that and have been doing it ever since. The Blind Pig in its original location, which is now Cowboy Monkey at 6 Taylor Street there, it opened in 1990. So this would have been 24 years ago?
I noticed on some of the old itineraries for the Great Cover-Up that it would say the Blind Pig, but was that when the Blind Pig was at that Cowboy Monkey location?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Got it.
Yep. So, yeah. So Blind Pig was there for 8 years where Cowboy Monkey is. Then Chris got out of music and the bar business and did his chemistry thing again for a few years. And then when he moved back to town, got back into the bar business, that's when he opened the Blind Pig again, but in a different location there over on Walnut Street. And then the new one, or the brew pub over where Dandelion is.
And the rest, they say, is history, I guess. I mean, that's 24 years worth of booking and promoting here in town. Now, are you local? Are you from the area?
Plus that extra year there helping my buddy. So, 25.
Okay. All right. Are you
25
from,
years.
Are you from Champaign-Urbana?
No, I grew up in Ohio. I graduated high school in Centerville, Ohio, and came to U of I to go to school and just never really left.
All right.
So...
A lot of people
are eager to get the hell out of here and get back to Chicago or get off to whatever real job they're going to do. But, you know, I think it's a great town. And obviously I've flourished here or whatever. I'm in no hurry to get out of here.
Well, I've dealt with a lot of promoters just playing in bands in Chicago and coming down here and starting to play around here. I had heard about you before I was in this band. I think without any competition, you have the highest Q rating of anyone I've ever encountered in this business.
Yeah, people almost Thanks. Like look at promoters and stuff like, oh man, those are shifty folk right there. Be careful with them. And I think sometimes the reputation is warranted.
Yeah.
But Ward, do you think that maybe your personality and the way that you handle bands? I look at Champaign-Urbana and people just talk about the Midwestern vibe and how friendly everybody is. And certainly Champaign-Urbana is this weird kind of case study of the big small town. So do you think that, I don't know, that your personality is sort of tailor-made for this area, for this music industry?
Perhaps, I guess. You know, I'm not entirely sure what has enamored me to so many people. I mean, part of it is the autonomy that owners have given me over the years, Chris Knight and now Nieto's. And I guess, you know, I've always worked with great staff, because I noticed that not only do people, like I said, enamored to bands and managers and agents and all that, but, you know, there's been so many times that the bands come through and they've said to me, they're just like, wow, your staff is so nice. And it's just like, well, really? Like, aren't they like that everywhere else? And they go, oh no. You ask them where the restroom is, or you ask them for a Coke in the middle of sound check, and you get the cold shoulder, and you get, So, you know, I guess I've just been, you know, I've had great owners who've given me a lot of autonomy to do what I need to do to make people happy. And I've had great staff around me that that helps complete the equation, I guess.
So do you handpick the sound guys that work your shows or your venues?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, you know, usually what you have, you just end up in a situation where you've got a guy who does 80 or 90% of them, you know, and then if he's needs the night off or he's going sick or out of town or something like that, you've got a plan B guy or a second string guy you go to, or third string or whatever. So you know, and eventually, you know, hopefully you've got a great sound guy, hopefully he leaves you sooner rather than sooner.
Mm-hmm.
But generally whenever that happens, you know, if a sound guy's with you for 2 or 3 years, by the time he's ready to move on for whatever reason, you've sort of, that your second stringer there has moved into the situation where, you know, awesome, you're going to be a great first stringer. So you just keep working with it. People move on, or, you know, people move around.
Yeah, that's why with I mean, every time we play Cowboy Monkey and Derek handles the sound, it's just like, ugh. And people that come see us, and they may have seen us in multiple venues, and they always say, man, whenever you guys play here, you guys just sound the best here. And the funny thing about Cowboy Monkey specifically is you know, and I guess it's kind of subjective, but the sound there is kind of naturally boomy and reverby, which I love in a live setting. I don't necessarily want a dry sound, but that's got to present challenges to Derek or anyone that's doing sound there that they wouldn't get in a smaller room, whatever that may be.
Sure. Yeah. And again, that goes back to me saying being surrounded by, you know, a great staff, and part of that is the sound guides. I guess I've also pretty much always been fortunate to have a sound guy who's not only got the ear and the knack for, you know, the equipment that he's, you know, the cards he's dealt with in terms of equipment, but generally always I've had guys who have a great social set or set of social skills to go along with it that can, you know, massage a situation if you do get into a tricky area or something like that. But yeah, it's great to have good sound guys and good sound equipment. Again, that you know, that goes back to owners as well, putting in money to a, you know, decent PA and upgrading and upkeeping Cowboy Monkey, etc.
Without naming names, or you can name names if you'd like here, but you mentioned sticky situations and having a staff that can kind of handle those. And, you know, firsthand experience, I mean, and I guess it depends on a band. I would imagine that traveling bands might be a little bit more short-fused than a local band coming to play a venue that's 5 minutes away. What is something that sticks out, like a bad experience? I know most of them are good experiences, but from your perspective, have you ever had to come clean up a situation that was just, whoa, that you'd never seen before?
Yeah, you know, there's been a number along the way. I'll try to remember, I guess a couple that I can remember is that, Yola Tango, this was back when Cowboy Monkey was Blind Pig, Yola Tango was playing, and I think, if I recall, there was an issue with one of the monitors, you know, one of the four monitors or three monitors or something like that. You know, sound guy was like, okay, well, let's, you know, we're here at this point. Let's go ahead and do this. Let's do the sound check, and I'll take care of repairing that monitor after we get done with that, you know, before the show starts. I've got an hour window there after sound check. I'll take care of that. You'll be good to go then. And, you know, Ira from Yola Tango was like, no, we're just going to sit here till you get that, you know, and started to, you know, restring his guitar, and you know, things like that can really put you behind the eight ball in terms of timing on a night, you know, if you're planning on opening at a certain time or starting at a certain time. So, you know, I forget exactly what I did, but you know, you got to get in there and sort of, I don't know,
kind of like peer mediation, right?
Yes. Yeah, see what can you do to further this along? What can you, you know.
Well, my best memory of playing a Cowboy Monkey, it was one of those shows where nothing was going right. I think you remember those.
And the bass, the kick drum, the little legs were broken, so it was literally rolling like a steering wheel. And what else is going wrong with that show?
There was something with a hi-hat, but the sound guy, I've never seen someone so committed to fixing something quickly. That he was just sprinting up from the back through a sea of people, and just, you could see the beads of sweat because he ran back and forth probably 7 or 8 times. And 20 minutes into the show, you know, it was an 80-minute set, that's still pretty early. He had everything ready, and
yep,
and he was just sitting back in the sound booth after that, doing a killer job for us.
It's stuff like that that makes it easy to kind of romanticize even the earliest stages of being in a band and being on stage, and just like all the, you know, you hear all these kind of cliches a lot, like, oh, the blood, sweat, and tears that go into it. But, you know, like when you see something like that, where literally your crew that's working on the show, it's you, you're your own roadies. The sound guy's really the only guy there that's going to bail you out of a situation like that. Mm-hmm. And he does. And it's like, yeah, rock. I mean, that's the thing. It's like rock and roll. Yeah. You know, it sort of validates all these kind of romantic notions that we have about it.
Yeah, because apparently he could also sit back, you know, sit back there behind the board and say, "Screw you guys!"
Yeah, we wouldn't have to do
it. I'm not getting any paid more for damage control here. I'm just gonna let it ride.
So you went on tour with Hum. I read an article. It was an interview that you did with the News Gazette a few months ago, and they asked about your favorite memory in, you know, in a career in music, and that was it, going on tour with them. I get in my mind when I see something like that, and I'm guessing, was this after they had the hit and they were touring behind that song, or was this it's, real, like...
It was both. All three. It was before the hit and during the hit and after the hit. I knew a couple of guys in the band, and just, I don't know. This was at the time, shortly thereafter, that I was had started at Blind Pig. You know, I knew bands, I knew these guys, and just said, "Hey, if you know, something I'd always wanted to do was travel and tour in a band myself, and this wasn't probably going to happen for me, but you know, throwing it out there to some other people, and I got invited along for a 2-week tour or something. You know, just hopped in the van, you know, to sell T-shirts for them and load gear and drink some free beer, and basically it was a 2-week vacation for me. That
sure,
fortunately, those guys, you know, lucked out in a number of ways, were in the right place at the right time, and it went from being, you know, just some dinky little 2-week tour of dinky little clubs for $50 a night to, I wouldn't say a full-time job, but, we went on a number of, you know, we went out there a number of times, and it, you know, grew to the point where it wasn't just me with them. It was also, you know, I was, it went, I guess at the height, there was four of us. I was doing lights and merchandise. Another guy was tour manager, and we also had a guitar tech, and we also had a sound guy. So, you know, at one point there was eight of us. There was four in the band and four in the crew. And, this was, and we went, you know, with, through the height. Yes. When Stars was biggest, they did a 30-day tour opening for Bush.
Wow.
Bush, the Toadies, and Hum. Hum and the Toadies alternated on nights depending upon which market they were bigger in, which was basically the Toadies played the middle slot in Texas and in Florida, and Hum played everywhere else. That was the height of it. That was the height of Stars. And, you know, they got off the road for a little bit after that, but went out again, and, you know, they were consistently playing, you know, 1,000 capacity venues and, you know, selling, you know, 500 to 1,000 tickets and doing, you know, $1,000 in merch a night. And, it was a great time.
So, and this includes, I'm sure, the stories of sleeping in the van and then having to get cleaned up in a convenience store, like just all those little road stories that you read about in the, you know, the Zeppelin biographies and things like that. I mean, everyone starts somewhere.
Yeah. You can go through all the, you know, even when you're playing 1,000 capacity venues and selling them out, you're still doing, you know, strange things like overnight drives where, you know, half of you are sleeping or somebody's sleeping on the floor in the back of the van. Or
I remember seeing
you know, drive 36 hours to make a certain show, or, you know, bad weather. And yeah, you get there just before your sound check or just before you play, and you make do. So
now I know that there's a story of Hum being on the road with a band that was about to break, and it turned out being the Roots. Were you along with that, or?
Yeah, the first time that we were it was Lollapalooza Side Stage.
Was this when it was a touring show?
It was a touring thing, okay. Yes. And we both, and so on the side stage, they I can't remember if they had like a couple, two bands that like played the whole tour, but there was definitely a rotation. So Hum started in Austin, Texas, as did the Roots, and we played like Austin, Phoenix, two LA shows. I can't remember where else. Probably Dallas, Austin, Dallas, and Phoenix, and two in LA. But yeah, that was the first time that I'd seen the Roots. That was back when Rozelle still played with them. And I vividly remember that, the girl Kristen, who was running the side stage, who was actually Hum's assistant manager, came rushing into the hospitality tent because she needed, the Roots were supposed to be on and playing in about 15 minutes, and they were nowhere, Questlove was nowhere to be found. And I can vividly picture Questlove on the back of a golf cart being driven to the side stage, and he's sitting there in the back of the golf cart eating his food, because they whisked him out of hospitality where he was probably eating, you know, a late lunch or an early dinner or something like that. And he brought his food on stage and he set it down next to the drum kit, you know, and it was wild. I want to say in between a couple songs, he would pick it up and take a bite off of a chicken wing and stuff some mashed potatoes in his mouth, put it back down, and then just go back to his, you know, they would go back into, they were amazing.
Yeah.
They were amazing to see, you know, for like that, 3 or 4 nights in a row.
And
five
I
nights.
I think they broke with their first hit right at that moment.
Was it Seeds? Was that their first hit? Or am I thinking that was pretty well into their career? Seed 2.0 or something? The Seed. Well, the dance.
It's the record before Philadelphia. Half-Life. What's the.
Yeah.
Do You Want More?
Yeah, I think that might be it. I have all of them on my iPod, and just over the last like 3 weeks, I've started delving into it, but I just don't have that bank yet.
Yeah, I'm sure, pretty sure we played some other, either a festival or an outdoor event or something like that with them at some point.
So, one other thing from this News Gazette article that stood out to me, they just asked about some of your early influences, or the bands that really got you the most, and you also respond to how, yeah, you know, my musical taste hasn't changed too much. One of the bands, I think the first one it listed, was The Clash.
Sure.
And I think that's a pretty cool, I mean, well, obviously it's a great choice because they're just a fantastic band. And you also said Dream Concert, The Clash, with Topper Heaton on the drums, which is absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
So when it comes to The Clash, you know, every band...
And Mick Jones.
Gotta have Mick Jones. And with The Clash, and this goes for some bands, but not all. Some bands like an AC/DC, they got their formula. That's what they do and they're great at it. But then you have other bands like The Clash or U2 or something like that, where each album, there's a different color to it. There's a different, I don't know. It just, The Clash seems like a very chameleon-like band that could really do anything. Was there an aspect of The Clash that you liked specifically, or was it the fact that they could do basically anything and do it pretty well?
Good question. I mean, I liked him initially because the first two records, you know, were just great, not even necessarily punk rock, but just rock.
Yeah.
Records.
Do you prefer the self-titled or Give Him Enough Rope?
That's a good question.
Safe European Home, I think, out of any track on the
first
show.
They're both great. I'm such a, Clash junkie. I don't know if I could pick between those two. But then, you know, I've always liked, or eventually, I liked all genres. So, you know, as a band like that was experimenting with other genres, I was perfectly fine with that, you know, with dub reggae or, you know, whatever else that those guys dabbled in. It just kind of, it was one of those bands, just whatever they did was golden.
Disco with the Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, there you go. The Overpowered by Funk, you know, some of the stuff on the
Sandinista.
Rock the Casbah.
Oh,
the non-hits on Rock the Casbah were pretty
combat rock,
a little bit wild. But you know, it's funny because you know, there's songs like Overpowered by Funk on that record that you listen to it like 10, 15 years later, and it's like, wow, this is what a lot of these indie bands are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Almost the same thing. It's just a decade and a half later.
Yeah, and the thing about The Clash, too, is, you know, I bought London Calling. I feel bad that I say that I bought, like, I'm surprised by that, because oftentimes I test things out first, you know, I think that's natural. But, you know, I bought London Calling back in 2006, because it was one of those things that I had read about in every time Rolling Stone did new top 100 albums ever or whatever.
Like two.
Yeah, and it was always there, and I thought, well, okay, it has to be good.
Gotta listen to that.
And I did, and it was immediate, and I was surprised how immediate it was, because it was really just, Sandinista, for instance, they go off the deep end, which can be great, but it can be a bit much to absorb. But for London Calling, even though it was a two-album set, it's really about 70 minutes in runtime, which you get some new releases now that are 70 minutes. And you could listen from track one to the very end and not get sick of it. And they're great pop songs. At the end of the day, that's what all of them are.
Yeah. I like that too. Pop songs. That's what, so much of rock and roll just is. It's, you know, it's got a hook. It's got a melody. It's catchy. Yeah, London Calling's got even like the, you know, piano-based songs like The Card Sheet.
Yes, yes. I love, that was one of the first ones I thought, that's really, you know, the pretty
old,
cool.
The like sort of blues of, whatchamacallit, Cadillac.
Yeah, Brand New Cadillac.
Brand New Cadillac.
There was a band that came through called Jane Rose and the Dead End Boys, and Alan, you weren't in the band yet, but we played a show at Mike and Molly's with them, and they're a rockabilly band. And they needed a lead guitarist, and each their lead guitarist got hurt or something, so they sent out a message to me. They were like, can you have anyone that fills in? And I listened to their music. I was like, well, I'm not great, but I can do that. And then they said, hey, we play Brand New Cadillac. The thing is, they were doing the original there, so I'm learning the Clash solo verbatim. And they see, I don't know if that's different from the original. I've never really.
I don't know if I've.
But for me, Brand New Cadillac by the Clash, that's the one. That's sort of the quintessential Brand New Cadillac. And I don't really care to hear the older versions because it's just, it's that good. Yeah. Hateful, right into Rudy Can't Fail. And
Rudy Can't Fail is one of the best.
Yeah. And you end with, yeah, technically, you end with Revolution Rock, but then you say, all right, here's the hidden track. One of the
greatest pop songs of all time.
Seriously,
Train and Vane.
God.
And before you got here, we were listening to the first Motley Crue album, and one of the things
fantastic.
That, yeah, I love that album. And one of the things that really
merry-go-round is just poetry.
Right. Well, one of the things that stands out about that album is before really the whole hair metal thing came about, that's a punk album.
Yeah.
And all of those songs, you cue them up and you're hard pressed to find one over 3 minutes, 30 seconds. And I think that's something that the Clash always had, was that they were a pop rock band that was based off of punk. So everything was always easily digested. Like, it was always a 3-4 minute song that,
yep,
right before you get sick of it, it ends.
Totally.
Yeah. I think the shelf life of a song, I mean, there's, this is a kind of out there example, I suppose, but Peter Gabriel. Do you guys listen to any old Peter Gabriel? And, you know, the early stuff still maintain that. It was really experimental and weird, but it was still about 3.5 minutes, 4 minutes long. And then his most recent stuff, it's like the editor, like I got my degree in journalism, so the editor gene in me comes out and I'm like, my God, this 7.5 minute song only needs to be 3.5. And this is coming from, I mean, I like the occasional epic song, or at least one that's epic in scope, even if it's not necessarily long. But yeah, I guess it's a fine line. So Ward, for you, some general questions here. First off, what, after 25 years of doing something like this, what are some of the gratifying things? Like, what would be something that you go home at night and you say, ah, job well done? Like, what would give you that sort of gratification?
Usually it's just when you see everybody leaving the venue with a smile on their face. You know, everybody had a good time, the band, the crowd, the staff, you know, even sometimes it's just, you know, if a show's underattended, you know, maybe as a promoter I lost money, but you know, even if you just have one person come up to you and tell you how much that show meant to you and meant to them and how amazing it was, that's pretty rewarding right there. Because I guess it's probably, you know, how I feel walking out of a lot of concerts, or, you know, concerts, especially when I was younger. It's like, man, you know, this blew my mind. This changed the way somebody thought.
For this is a question about Champaign Urbana and the music scene here. And how much has it changed over 25 years? And how would you characterize it? Because sometimes I have a tough time kind of putting my finger on, oh, well, you know, there's not a singular Champaign Urbana sound. That's for starters. But how would you characterize it? And is it different than 25 years ago?
I mean, it's certainly different, but it's kind of the same. It sounds silly to say, but, you know, it fluctuates, but there's always a great smattering of bands that are on the verge of doing something, you know, really great, or, you know, recording and, writing and releasing great stuff. There always has seemed to have been, you know, a nice plethora, or a nice, at least, set of options as far as venues go, you know, whether it be all ages or bars or small places, big places. So it has slight dips and or slight peaks and slight valleys, but in general it keeps just kind of chugging along. You know, it gets turnover, but you've got that constant influx of people coming in as well.
What's the last local band you saw and said, "Whoa, these guys"?
Probably We the Animals.
Okay.
I'm sure I've seen somebody since but that show that I remember telling Kayla that just like, wow, that's, you've got it. There's something special there.
Okay. Now, is that Joe Funderburk's new band? He's the drummer in that band.
Yeah. Mark, Michael, and, Joe. Yeah.
And is Kayla. I feel like I might be mistaken here. Does it have like elements of disco in it, or was it at all?
No,
or?
No, not at all.
Okay, then I don't know where I got that from.
You'll have to go check them out.
I'll have to go edit that just out of this podcast when I'm done, so I don't sound like an idiot.
There's a couple songs there that will just, especially one that will just stick in my head for days and days after. And to me, that's the sign of a great song, or especially a great pop song. If you keep humming it, keep singing it.
Yeah.
You know, somebody's done something right there.
I guess on the other end of that, I know that, like, when we play shows sometimes, we know that we underdrew. And there's always, but you've been nothing but accommodating through the entire thing. And is there ever a time where there's a band playing and you're just like, I have to cut ties with this? Like, this can't work anymore.
No, I don't think I probably ever really think that I need to cut ties with somebody when I'm watching. You know, I've learned over the years that you just, you know, you win some, you lose some. Hopefully you win more than you lose is what I always say. You know, mm-hmm. You're always going to have underattended, you know, nights. So you just got to kind of roll with it. I guess instead of in thinking cut ties, it's more of in my head, I will be thinking, how can I do this differently next time to make it work? What other situation can I find that this will work? You know,
what would you recommend to a band? Let's say there is a band that maybe they're 6 months into their existence and they're emailing every place. I mean, because I just remember when I started this in 2010 and I'm emailing every place, you know, and I think we played like 8 shows at Iron Post before finally, like, I think Mike and Molly's had us and stuff, and it was a gradual buildup. So would there be, is it the old idea that pay your dues? I mean, is that something that is universal, or is it something where certain bands different at ready times? And I don't know. Is there any formula really?
I don't know if I'd say pay your dues so much as just work at it and be persistent, you know? Don't play too many shows, but, you know, try to get yourself in the early stages there. Try to get yourself out there a couple times a month. You know, network with as many bands as you can. Just, you know, try to get your foot in the door so that you can jump on a bill that somebody else has that maybe they've, you know, been offered something or, you know. But, you know, take as many opportunities or create as many opportunities as you can, you know. If you've got friends that sometimes do house parties, you know, do a house party there. If there's, you know, if there's only one place that, like Iron Post, in your example, you know, just, you know, keep working that and try to, you know, hook up with the band that you played with that night. Say, hey, let's do something down the road next time you do something else. Or if you've, you know, happen to play with an out-of-town band, it doesn't necessarily have to be a Chicago band. You know, it could be a band from Charleston or Springfield, you know, just...
And return the favor. Hey, yeah. We'll come play down.
Do what you can, and, you know, not necessarily pay your dues, but be prepared to do it for dirt cheap and labor of love for a while until you can, you know, sort of get some sort of footing, you know, to where you can start spacing out your shows and taking, you know, picking and choosing and, you know, making each one count a little bit more, you know, promoted well and I don't know, just well thought out, well presented.
With I guess along with that, there's the promoter's job and just putting a band on a bill. Like, that takes enough, and then making sure everything's coordinated. And one thing I tell people I know who are, you know, a little behind the curve as far as promoting their own band, and then I find that I'm falling into the same traps myself. What are some things that you wish bands would do more often to help promote the show? What can a band do to make your job even easier and more profitable, really?
It's a good question. I mean, fortunately, in this day and age, you have social media, which, that's the first thing that my mind sort of thought of, is that, you know, just, you know, get on social media and do what you can. There's so much that you can do with that, you know, that bands didn't have available to them even, you know, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So just, you know, I see that sometimes where you'll book a band and they just won't, you know, I'll go to their, I'll go to their Facebook page on the week of, or even
no mention of it.
Yeah. Zero. Like, hey guys, help out here. Okay. I'm not saying you got to go door to door, cold calling people, whatever. Just put a post up there every once in a while. Just say, hey, here's where we're playing. Come. That's the whole reason you have a band site. You know, your band has a site on Facebook, is to tell people about stuff. So tell them. It's not like you have gigs every single day and it's, you know, a full-time job.
The social media thing is getting so tiring. People are probably sick of hearing about our daily show. Yeah. That's the thing, too, is that I'll jokingly, and I think sometimes, to be honest, if bands, as they're inviting people to shows and stuff like that and doing the mass invites, because I think about how many acquaintances, quote unquote, I have on Facebook that, for me, right now, it's just a matter of, you know what? If you send me a friend request, I'm probably going to accept it because guess who gets an invite to the next show? And it's like, I mean, it's a powerful tool.
It's the whole reason I got on Facebook.
Yeah.
That's all I really do. I don't do like my family stuff or personal stuff.
Throwback Thursday?
No. You know, people are like, you didn't see that? You don't read your news feed? Like, no, I don't really look at my news feed. I don't care about that. I just want to be in your news feed with a show I'm doing.
And we've tried to have fun with just, you know, the posters and stuff. And I mean, the thing is, if we had like a really cool print shop at our disposal, they'd be like, hey guys, here's 100 prints of your latest poster. But for us, it's just like, well, you know, just at least get the image out there. I mean, for whatever reason, and try to cultivate a brand and a look.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's fun to go back and look at something I might have made up in 2010. Like, man, I thought it was so cool back then. But really, the aesthetic of the band, as far as posters and stuff, I try to keep a thread through it. So it's like, oh yeah, that's their look, or oh yeah, that's the font for their band name or whatever.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
There's the whole idea of like being a foot soldier and getting out there and doing everything the hard way. And I remember when we first started, and it's something I haven't been doing lately and really would like to get back to, because at the time I was still in school. And when you're in school, if you have all the notes in front of you and you have a computer in front of you, you get a little bit distracted sometimes. And I would just send out over an hour, maybe 50 to 60 personal messages, not like a mass message, but like personal messages to the person, just saying like, hey, I haven't seen you since this time, but my band's playing a show here. Maybe you should come out. And I think that compared to just like the blanket invite, it's probably more effective.
Yeah. So finally, one kind of last thing we'll go into, some exciting stuff. One of the cooler things that goes on here on the Champaign Urbana music scene is an annual event that I'm sure many of our listeners already know about, but it's called The Great Cover-Up. And Ward, you've been personally involved with this since the inception, right?
Yes, indeed.
Was it your idea?
It wasn't.
Okay.
The guy who came up with it, he did artwork and graphic design for one of the biggest local band at the time called The Digits. And his wife worked for Muscular Dystrophy Association. So he concocted this as an idea, you know, it was a way to do a fundraiser for MDA, which was great. And then she got another job a couple years after that. So he basically booked the bands through, or with, you know, in conjunction with me. We put it together the first 2 years. He moved away to Milwaukee, and I just, it was so successful in the first 2 years, you know, just lying down the block that, you know, obviously kept doing it. So I did it in year three myself, and just kept doing it each year. You know, the community in Champaign-Urbana and all the, you know, the local music scene, all the musicians and music fans have just loved it from the get-go. So it's, there was, you know, maybe a period where it was dipped a little bit in interest, but, you know, that might have coincided with a year where there wasn't a lot of strong local bands. But it's, so this will be the 24th one coming up here in January. I would say it's gained a lot of momentum in the last 4 years, last 4 to 6 years. So it's, well, obviously, as you can see, that it keeps mushrooming from two nights to three nights,
to
three
five.
Nights to four nights. And last night I was like, I had so many bands wanting to do it. And, you know, I'm a more the merrier guy. So, you know, it's like, well,
is it to the point where you got to cut people out?
Yeah,
say,
it's
hey,
hard. You know, I want everybody to be involved, but at the same time, you know, you still want, you still want a certain quality to it, a certain aesthetic to it. So,
sure.
But you know, that, but so last year I was like, look, you know, just staring at a calendar for, you know, weeks on end. And finally, you know, I was like, well, let's do 5 nights this year. And, you know, let's stretch it out. And, you know, I think when it was first announced, people were like, really? 5 nights? And, but
they
when,
came.
It, when it came down to it, it, they were all 5 nights were crowded.
Man.
So, you know, the attendance was up there. I think, for the first time last year, I believe I cut the door off on one of the nights.
Wow.
Because, you know, it was packed. I was like, you know, it's too early here. We may or may not get 100 more people, but I can't, you know, if 100 more people show up, there's not going to be room for them. So I gotta go to a one in, one out. Fortunately, as I remember it, I only had to do that for about 20 minutes.
Okay.
And anybody that stood there for 10, 15 minutes, they eventually got in.
Sure.
But, yeah, it's, some of the nights are just jam packed.
Well, I would think one of the hard things, and it's probably why it was packed for 5 nights in a row, is if you get all of these bands together, you have not only the friends, but then I've been talking to a lot of people lately and mentioning that, you know, I was going to be, that there was the great cover up coming up, and I was hoping we'd play before anything. And
should we make it official?
Can we? Seven yes. People may learn.
Yes.
Yes, Decadence will be performing at the Great Cover Up the Sunday night. So that's the 3rd of 5.
Sunday night, January 18th.
Yeah.
But, and they said that they don't choose a band that they're going to. They just go for the.
They want to see the show.
Yeah.
Well, they probably pick the night or nights that are best for them. Yeah, because you always get a surprise. There's always some band that you haven't even heard of, but like, wow, where did that come from? You know?
Yeah. It's such a cool, I mean, it's a simple enough, concept, but at the same time, what I think is so cool about it. And as we've been preparing for it, having to put yourself as a band into the mindset of another band. Like if you really want to dedicate and be like, okay, how are they doing this and their style of playing everything? I'm excited to see like the results afterwards because we're absorbing all this stuff as much as we can for the band that we're covering. And it's like, ooh, well now what if this kind of seeps into our creative process for future songs and things like that? It's a really cool mindset to go into.
And I'm sure you get this question all the time, but in 24 years, I'm sure a few have just walked away.
I mean, it's gone on so long now that it's, you know, I could talk for days about great performances or whatever. So, I don't know. Generally, I tend to just either go back to, I don't know. I was going to say I go back to some from the early years that always stuck, or I just try to think of some in the most recent, like 1 or 2 years, like last year or something like that. In the way back, I remember a poster children's set. Where they did the Who, and when they came out of the break on Won't Get Fooled Again, it was just astounding.
He hit the Roger Daltrey scream and
yeah. So before that, Johnny Machine, John Herndon, who actually will be in town tomorrow night with the Sea and Cake. Sea and Cake, he's in Tortoise, my bad. Anyway, John Herndon, at the time, his nickname was Johnny Machine, but his Keith Moon fills before you got to the Keith to the Roger Daltrey scream. Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing.
Okay. You see, I've always thought that'd be such a cool song to cover, except for the whole, the sequenced keyboard thing. Did they pre-record it? They have a keyboard section doing
it. I don't remember
it.
How they did that, because this was, 20 years ago, so.
So no matter what, there was no easy way around it.
Yeah. Temple of Low Men doing Rage Against the Machine was pretty amazing.
Wow.
I mean, anytime Brandon T. Washington gets up there, it's pretty amazing. But,
yeah. Is he going to be involved this year?
He is. I'm not sure which acts exactly he's with, but I'm sure he'll be up there with a couple, which is fantastic.
Yep.
He's a great sideman and or compliment to whatever you do. And that's another great thing about the cover-up is it becomes such of a community thing, not just the people coming to it, but the musicians. There tends to be a lot of collaboration and cameos and just things that don't normally happen.
And then, all right, I'm sure in 24 years, obviously there have been some great local bands who have come out of there. Have there been any surprise bands that came from Chicago? Am I missing some story of Smashing Pumpkins coming down? And
no, it's always been local bands. In fact, there's been bands that have moved away and are can we do it again? It's like, you've been in Chicago for a couple of years. There's too much interest with local bands here to do that. I mean, that would be amazing to have some local bands, some Chicago bands or regional bands like that involved too. But there's enough talent here at home that I keep it local.
Yeah. Are there some other first time performers? Like I said, it's our first time doing the cover up with Pump Board. Are there other ones that are getting their first go?
Yeah, that generally what happens is generally you've got about at this point usually you've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 bands who perform. The general rule is if you play one year, you're sort of invited and welcome back. I don't think I've ever kicked. No, I've never kicked anybody to the curb.
So no awful performances.
There's been some questionable ones, but
you gave a second chance.
But yeah, sure. Yeah. But anyway, out of about 25 bands, generally you have somewhere like 6-7 who have either graduated and everybody's moved away, or the band's broken up, or they've split off and they're doing different things, and they're writing, recording, and playing out live in the normal fashion that they were, or they've just been dormant for a year or something like that. So usually you've got a good 70% return rate from the bands, and that sort of opens up, like I said, 6, 7, 8, slots for, bands who haven't done it before or maybe skipped a year or two. Like Elsinore didn't do it for 2 years. I think in one of those 2 years, Ryan did it solo. But
are they back this year?
Elsinore will be back this year.
And they were Nirvana last year, I think. Is that
they
correct?
Were.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Elsinore, great band. Ryan's has been super helpful with the recording process and everything we did with him. And
another person with an outstanding Q rating in the area.
Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. Deservedly. And then other heavy hitters, Elsinore being one of them, but other bands that are some of the more well-known names in the area?
Let's see. I could sort of rattle it off for you if you want, as I've been staring at it for weeks on end. On Thursday the 15th, which would be the first night, you've got Terminus Victor, Wrist, Resonator, Thunder Truck.
I like and Thunder Truck sound.
And
that's
six
cool stuff.
And 16 Tons.
Okay.
Who you guys don't know, but they played the first three or four great cover-ups. So this will be they did a reunion show about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
Maybe 2 years ago. And this year they said, hey, can we get in a great cover-up again? I said, of course you can.
That's pretty
sweet.
So this
will be This will be their first appearance. This will be like their fifth appearance, but their first appearance in 20 years.
Wow.
Pretty amazing.
That's pretty sweet.
They're going to ready for decades in
2032.
Friday the 16th would be Mike Ingram, Beat Kitchen, Abnormous, 17 Sisters, The Ars Nova.
Good band.
And Katie Flynn.
What's the last one?
Katie Flynn.
Okay. Is she in Cody and the Gateway Drugs?
She's not with them anymore. So she's doing her own thing for this.
Great vocalist, though.
Yep. On the Sunday night, you guys are playing, as I think, Curb Service, 90s Daughter, Brother Embassy, Andy Moe, and Dead Possums, Decadence, and James Jones Trio.
Cool.
Thursday, the second Thursday, which would be the 22nd. The Dirty Feathers, We the Animals, drawing a blank. Tiger Beat, Hi-Ho Buffalo, Rebecca Rigo, and the Train Men.
I'm excited to see Hi-Ho Buffalo because we did a show with them too.
Yeah.
And that's some cool original stuff that they're doing.
They're excited. They've got a good little twist up their sleeve I heard about, yesterday. And then the final night, which is Friday the 23rd, Elsinore, Grandkids, Terra Terra, Acme Principal, Motes, and I think I've still got one TBA that I need to work out.
Sweet. So Elsinore, are they closing that Friday?
Elsinore's closing on Friday the 23rd, yep.
Are they going to top Nirvana?
I'm sure they will. I mean, yes.
Now, has every band already given to you, hey, here's who we're playing? And-
yeah.
Okay.
So everybody is supposed to tell me who they're doing and does, just so that I can sort of ensure that nobody does any duplicates. So,
sure.
That, you know, if Elsinore is planning on doing ZZ Top, that, you know, a band in two slots before them doesn't bust out a ZZ Top set and have the guys in Elsinore going, what the hell?
But Elsinore's like, no, we're only doing Eliminator songs.
They stole our thunder. So everybody tells me, and I keep a little list to make sure and sort of coach some of them on, you know, repeats weren't allowed for the first 10 or maybe 15 years, and then finally it was like, yeah, you can do a band that's already been done. Just think about who did it, how well they did it, and how long ago they did it. So
yeah, that was the thing we were debating, and I need to be careful. Yeah, I could always edit out if I said the names that we were thinking of. Oh, well, we could cover this band, we could cover that band, and we kept coming back to one, and then we had discovered that yes, there was years ago, but then I did some digging. I'll be honest, I was a little heartbroken. I was like, oh, man, why'd they have to do that? Even though I should have known that someone would have tried this out. But it was a different style. I was like, okay, I think we can still do this. I think we can. It's going to be exciting now. And this is our first time playing it. And even though I've been a lifelong resident, I sadly, as blasphemous as this sounds, I've yet to be at...
What?
Yeah.
I've been here for 3 years, and I've been to all three.
I know. It's...
Well, now you'll be there. You'll be there every year now.
How many bands?
And if you're playing on Sunday night, my guess is you're going to come on Thursday and Friday again too, or one of those two nights.
No, I am, because I want to just kind of, you know, see the scene and
got to come see what Elsinore does now that we've been talking.
Yes, and I'm excited to see that too. When bands do, any of them pre-promote? Here's who we're playing, or are they all really hush hush about it?
Good question. I think it's a little bit of half and half. A lot of bands they'll freely talk about it, either because they don't know how to keep a secret or don't want to keep a secret, mm-hmm. or they're really excited to tell people what they're doing, you know, to sort of build some hype. The flip side of that, the other half of the groups are very secretive, and don't want anybody to know, and they don't let the cat out of the bag until even till the end of the first song. You know, a lot of bands will tell me and the sound guy, hey, don't project the band's logo that we're doing on the back wall until after the first song. We want people to think about it, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of bands sort of get off on that, where, you know, people are scratching their heads during the first, you know, the opening notes or the first couple minutes of a song, thinking, where are they going with this? What are they doing? So, and then there's even been a couple been a couple great bait and switch maneuvers from people where they say all along, oh, we're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this. And then they get on stage and they're doing something completely different. And everybody's bewildered and floored at the same time.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a way to kind of like cleverly promote it and give hints. I don't know. I think it'll be fun to drop.
Sounds like Mike wants to let the cat out of the bag.
No, well, that's the thing. It's like any secret. You want to tell people, but at the same time,
it's a good one.
It's going to be more fun. And, you know, now I'm just thinking, okay, what's the image we're going to put on the back wall? And like, yeah, a lot of cool things. And it's a great production and it's going to be cool to be a part of it. So
I've had fun with it. Like you said, the bait and switch thing where if I'm talking to someone about it, they'll ask what it is. And I'll be next to someone that I told something else, and I'll be like, we're doing Hall & Oates. And they're like, Hall & Oates? Like, no, I've lied to everybody.
And they come out and play Slayer. They play a 20-minute Slayer set. Well, it's going to be exciting. And Ward, thanks for coming by. I know we took
totally.
It's always fun talking music. And for someone that's been involved in the area for 25 years, promoting, booking shows, I guess one last quick question, kind of the Inside the Actors Studio style, how they do the quick hitters. But this would be the last one that I would probably ask any guest that we have on in future episodes. The single greatest concert moment. It could be an entire concert. It could be a song at a concert or just something, you know, happening within the confines of wherever you were seeing this go down. But what would be the concert moment that you always recall and say, yeah, that right there?
Oh, wow.
I mean, you've seen
fortunately,
a few concerts
I've
in your life.
You know, I've been blessed to have had so many of those moments. You know, that's why I go to see live music, is to see those moments. I know that one of the most recent ones was at Canopy Club when Drive-By Truckers played, and they did a song called "The World of Hurt." That the lyrics are amazing, and then Cooley, the guitarist, just peeled off on this monster like 6 minute long guitar solo, and it was everybody that I was with, and you were looking around at each other like, are we really really watching this and experiencing this?
Yeah.
Well, the answer was yes. Another moments I will never forget is the U2 360 tour and having a general admission field floor standing general admission ticket or whatever, and being basically on the 50-yard line at Soldier Field, and within, I don't know, 20 yards. But anyway, being in the center of 70,000 people listening and watching one, basically the greatest rock band on the planet. That experience standing at Soldier Field watching U2. I did it twice. I went to both those because the first one was so great I had to go back again.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll never forget those moments. Just standing there just in awe of where I was standing, what I was doing, and the music that was melting my brain.
I still say the coolest moment of any show, and this goes with all the great music that you see afterwards, but I will never, ever, ever get sick of when, okay, all right, it's 8:15. They're going to be coming out any minute here, okay? And then finally the house lights go off. Like, you start listening to the house music, and I remember one time seeing Van Halen in 04. It wasn't a good show because Eddie was drunk, and it was Sammy Hagar, and he was signing autographs half the time. But Stranglehold by Ted Nugent was playing, and it reached that middle solo that goes on for about 3.5 minutes, and it was just this palpable tension. And then right when those house lights go off, and it really wouldn't matter what's on the house speakers at that point, and that crowd erupts, and it's like, I'm never gonna get sick of that. I don't care. It's
when the lights go down and the roar of the crowd goes up. Yeah, it's magical.
Well, episode 5, Declan's Podcast. It was cool having our first ever guest, Ward Gollings, booker,
thanks,
promoter in town. Thanks for stopping by. And
thank you so much.
Yeah, we'll be seeing you. Let's see. It is December 11th. We're recording this. Well,
maybe I can come back in January and talk more about the great cover-up.
Yes, I think we should. That would probably be episode 9. And somewhere between then, I'm sure we'll... We need to take some other guests to have on the show, too.
I mean, I'd love to talk to Ryan.
I need to email Ryan. It'd be great to have him on. It'd be great to get Cody Sokolsky on.
Maybe we could get the two together and we could talk about the closing for...
We can have a pre-show. We can have a post-show. We can have one before the Great Cover Up and one to wrap it up and talk about some of the highlights from it. I think that's a good idea. We should do that. All right. So for Alan Beebe.
Thank you.
I'm Mike Carpenter. Thanks to Ward Gollings for coming in.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time on the Deckman's Podcast. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.